I saw a sermon the other day. And it's remarkable when you think about that expression, I saw a sermon, because normally when we talk of sermons, we say, I heard a sermon. Someone stands before you, or you tune in on television or radio and you hear a sermon. But let me read something to you that is in our that was in our church bulletin last Sabbath in Detroit, and I did not know it until after I gave the sermon that was entitled, I Saw a Sermon the Other Day. It's entitled, Sermons We See. It says, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I'd rather one should walk with me than merely point the way. The eye is a better pupil and more willing than the ear. The counsel is confusing, but example is always clear. And the best of all the preachers are those who live their creed. For to see the good in action is what everybody needs. Now that was in the our church bulletin, and I took it to heart after the sermon, because I did see a sermon the other day. It unfolded like this. Next door to me, and I'm living in my mother's home, who 2 years ago we lay to rest in Detroit, and so this is even fresher in my mind as we navigate through this time of the year. There was a young lady living there, and she was locked out of her home as I drove into the driveway one day, and I have these ubiquitous cell phones, so she asked to use it to call her parents to come by to let her in. And that was the first introduction of my next door neighbor. Not much was said, because I don't know anybody on our block, even though my mother lived there for 30 years. I don't know anybody by name except one family, a young lady who was a caregiver to my mother and her two children. I know them by name, but everybody else on the block, you know, you do that, hi, how you doing, and keep on moving, you know, kind of thing. And that's how we are. Well, lo and behold, several weeks later, in fact, about a month ago, more people showed up at this house, including her mother and father, and all of these children. And my first thought was, oh no, it's going to be loud around here now. All of these children, you know, young children, they're going to be running on the grass, they're going to be doing this. I had every negative response. But one day, a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting on the porch, and Mrs. Glover, it's the Glover family, was out with her children, and she had two of her grandchildren also staying with her, which increased the number of children present. And I decided I'm going to engage her in a conversation and just kind of find out who this lady is. And I suspected that she was a foster parent, because the children in their pigmentation told me that these were not all her children. One of them looked very white. Turns out his name is Arturo Martinez. So that answered that question. But there was another little kid who was a little darker than he, which showed a mixture, you know, kind of thing. And I said, oh, that must be his brother. Well, it turns out to be his brother, but different fathers kind of thing, you know. And I'm looking at this, and I'm listening to her conversation. She said to me, in the course of her presentation to me, well, 9 years ago, I started being a foster parent because my daughter, the one who lived here, and I found out she was 22. She doesn't act 22. She acts as she has some challenges, you know, with her life, even in her gait and her walk. She displays a difficulty in navigating. But I had no idea, as her mother told me, she had had 84 brain operations. Now, with water on the brain, hydroencephalic, I think I pronounced that correctly, they usually put a shunt in to drain the fluid. And every now and then, this tubing gets infected, and so you have to constantly monitor the situation in her life. And I thought to one of the members in our congregation who has a defibrillator encased inside of her, but not a small one either, a heavy one. I held it in my hands once, and I thought, you got to carry this around inside of you. But the tubing gets infected every now and then. You've got to go back in there and clean it out and all of that. And I'm thinking about this young lady. She's 84 operations. That's just on the brain. She's had leg operations as well, and she's going through all of this stuff. But then her mother said something quite interesting. She says, 9 years ago, because my daughter had survived all of these things, I asked God to give me an opportunity to express thanks to him. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. This is the neighbors that I'm dreading. She's having this approach to the situation of her life. She said, yeah, 9 years ago, I began foster care to say thanks to God. 100 children later, she has kept 100 children, other people's children, for 9 years as an act of appreciation to God for his gift of her daughter. I was stunned. Then she had the unmitigated gall to say to me, I don't get to go to church much. And my immediate response was, you are the church. I want you to think about that. I want you to consider this sermon I saw the other day. Because these children that she has kept come from disparate situations and tragic circumstances. They've been taken from their parents because of abuse, neglect, and even drug addiction. I have some knowledge and understanding of that because I have a goddaughter who's in her 40s, who when she found out that a relative of hers had given birth to a child and the child was missing and the mother was missing, she suspected that this mother who had birthed this child was on drugs, crack in particular. She went searching for the child. The child was 2 weeks old. She found the child in a crack house and paid $25 as the bill that this woman had accrued to get the child, and she's had her for 18 years. The sermons that I see when I open my eyes are astounding. Absolutely astounding. And we could go on and on, like the two gentlemen who lost their lives here in Flint as volunteer firemen from Noonday, an area here in the East Texas area. Volunteer firemen on call 24/7 to go into harm's way to serve the greater good of a community. And I got to thinking about the church and its place within its communities. You want to see the church grow? Do something good for somebody else. Don't preach to them. Don't stand and argue about doctrinal imperatives. That will not do it. But I don't want to digress. I don't want to beat up on anybody. I just want to tell you more about this sermon I saw, because I began wrestling with it, because this is the 40th anniversary of my going to Pasadena. 40th anniversary. It was the end of July 1967 that I packed up whatever I had in a car with George Corey, a Middle Eastern guy who had a car, and we drove across 3 days to Pasadena and drove onto campus on that Friday evening. Bible study was canceled, you know, because of the threats of riots. I just left Detroit in the middle of its riot of 1967, and so there was unrest all over the country and concern, and they canceled the Bible study. The first guy I met on campus was Ray Pyle. Now, the Pyle family name, for those who've been around the church, would recognize that, and Ray Pyle was a senior, about to become a senior at Ambassador College, but he didn't know us from Adam, as the saying goes. And when we pulled on the campus, here's this black guy, and this Arab guy, or a Middle Eastern, he's not an Arab, but he's Syrian, I believe he is. But he got very dark coming across the desert, you know? So here we are pulling on campus asking about where is the Bible study. And he pretended like not to know. What are you talking about? So we had to identify the fact that we're from the Detroit church. Art Mocaro is our pastor, et cetera, et cetera. And then he relaxed a little bit and says, well, it was canceled for the reasons I've stated. And so the next Sabbath service that afternoon with some of the college students who were still around, and coincidentally, I met his future wife, Brenda May, the very next day. It's interesting that they would eventually marry, divorce, and all of that, but still, I met them. And I walk into the very first Sabbath service in Pasadena, and the thing that is said to me by one of the super deacons is not welcome, glad to have you in church. It was, don't you know that all the Negroes go to Los Angeles to church? I've just moved 2,400 miles, walked into a church, and the first greeting I get is a negative. Now, I want you to go back in your mind and see and replay the negativity with which people are approached in the church circles. Don't you know? What are you doing? Not welcome. Not with all your spots and wrinkles and crinkles and all of that. Come on in, because this is a hospital for those who need to get well, spiritually speaking. But let's argue about some stuff. Let's bring up some issues that you ought to know about. Don't you know about third tithe, my brother? You know, that kind of thing. Oh, it happens all the time. And I'm looking at some informed people who know that that is true. And yet, when I think back to this sermon I saw the other day, the daughter, Marvella is her name, asked me one day, well, where is your church? I got to, you know, doing that balancing act. Oh, where's my church? Okay, should I bring it to my church? Should I let her be exposed to people who are going to argue about, you make the list up. I won't mention the list, but, you know, they're going to argue about this, that, and the other thing. Now, that's not the way the Detroit church is. Thanks be to God that they've matured from some of that. But, you know, there are people in our worship and fellowship who will not invite people on the basis of what they're going to be exposed to. They just won't. And so we don't grow. We see a diminution within our flocks and our congregations on the basis of the apprehension. But when she asked me that, I identified what it was, and I got to see on the 12th of August, a day before my operation, we're going to have a picnic. It's an annual picnic that we have. And then the Sabbath before, we're going to have a friends and family Sabbath. And we're inviting whomever can come. Our situation and facility can be overtaxed. That's all right. But we're going to invite them to come. To come to friends and family day or weekend, as the case might be. No preaching to them. No trying to get them straightened out. Just come in and let us love on you a little bit. Can we do that? Getting back to Mrs. Glover, this situation is compounded. I know I haven't read a text yet. I haven't given you a scripture and all of that, but I think there are some scriptures that should come to mind, and I'm going to go to one in particular. It may be the only one I get to. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Now, what compounds the situation with the Glover family is that Mr. Glover is on dialysis three times a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. I heard the Saturday, and I said, oh, if he's got to go to dialysis on Saturday, that makes it difficult for him to go to church if I were to invite him to church, because it's a five-hour process. Okay, so there's a reason. And there are those who are familiar with dialysis and know what it has. Is that right, Pete? You know what I'm talking about. So that's an encumbering circumstance, but I'm challenged by it because as I watch Mrs. Glover work with her grandchildren, they stepped on the grass or tried to run on the grass. She says, nope, don't run on the grass. The grass says, ouch. And they just laughed, you know, because she used some humor to make a point to them. One day I pulled into the driveway and Arturo was about to run across my grass. As I walked from the side of the house, I have a pavement area from the driveway to the pavement of the house, but not all the way across the grass. He was just about to run across when I stepped around the corner and he whoops, changed his direction and went down the pavement and on down to where he was headed. When I drive in, you know what Arturo calls me? He says, "Hello, neighbor." He's about 7 years old. "Hello, neighbor." He keeps asking me my name, but you know, neighbor is so easy. And I'm thinking, when did I first come to the concept of neighbor? Neighbor, and what that means. Here's this young kid using this term and being very expressive about it. Where did he get that? Well, he gets it from this woman who has adopted him because she knows he will never go back to his parents because of the condition from which he was extracted. You're talking about a sermon lived every day that I'm confronted with every day. And I had to repent of the attitude, "I don't want those people moving next door to me." You follow what I'm saying? Now, in the book of Amos and Micah, those are two places I want to go. There were just so many texts that I could go to. I mean, the very first chapter of Isaiah talks about God being upset about how his holy days are observed by people of God. "Away with you and with your Sabbaths and holy days and your sacrifices and so forth." He is not saying that the Sabbath is done away with. He is not saying that the holy days are done away with, but how you use them. And Jesus had an issue with the Pharisees of his day. But in the book of Amos, and this very famous passage in the fifth chapter of Amos, he was a farmer by trade, but God selected him to be a prophet, you know, and God is able to do that. It says in verse 21, I despise your feast days, and I will not smell in your solemn assemblies this odor, the sweet savor that's supposed to come up to God. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them, neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take you away from me the noise of your songs. I will not hear the melody of your viols. But then he says something that Dr. King used frequently in his preaching or in his messages. "But let judgment or justice run down as water, and righteousness as a mighty stream." Justice, righteousness. "Have you offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? But you have borne the tabernacle of your Molech and Chun, your image, the star of your God, which you made to yourselves." We have in our society the worship of idols. Sometimes those idols are things we acquire or things we have as an accident of birth, like being born in Texas. Accident of birth. I'm a Texan. What does that mean to anybody, really, who lives in Oklahoma? You know, the Battle of the Red River kind of stuff. You know, or you live in Arkansas. You know, we live in places in a blessed country, but we like to think of ourselves as superior, and so we worship an accident of birth versus worshiping the Creator who made us all in his image. Well, this is just one passage, but over in Micah, Micah asks a very potent question. And it's in chapter 6, verse 6 says, "Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old?" Now, this is in the context of the ancient worship in the temple with the Levitical priesthood. We know that the transformation in the New Testament is that we worship God in sacrificial giving of ourselves versus the animals we once that were once sacrificed in the context of ancient Israel. So shall I come with that kind of offering? Verse 7 says, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? We can translate that to thousands of hours and 10,000 days, as the case might be, of coming to worship before him at the Feast of Tabernacles and all of the holy days and every Sabbath that comes. Here we are, sacrificing. Could be on the golf course, could be at the mall, could be in a lot of places, you know, people would say. But I'm sacrificing because that's what God expects of me. Well, let's read on. Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, or justice, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? Now, that's quite a different standard by which we accumulate a judgment on what God requires of us. We argue about a lot of things relative to the scriptures as to what's important and what we ought to be doing, and why aren't they doing it? And here we are doing it, and we're doing it better than those who also are doing the same thing because we are who we are. You know what I'm saying? We get into all of that. But when it comes down to it, when I did an analysis of my life of 30 years of preaching, as I sat on that porch next to my neighbor, who was of more value? When you really get down to it. And that's hard to digest. First of all, it's hard to ingest in order that it can digest. It is very difficult to make that kind of analysis because coming up in an environment and in a church situation where you are the one true church and everybody else had missed the mark and missed the boat. Now, the Church of God International has not held that persuasion of being the one true church. There are those in our midst who do, but most of us, the leadership is that God is operating in a lot of places among a lot of people, and we need to be awakened to that reality and begin to analyze it in a potent kind of way. Well, if those two scriptures were not specific enough, I got to thinking really about Matthew 25 to help me solidify my thinking, being exposed to this powerful message, this powerful sermon that's preached every day. As I watch Mrs. Glover and Mr. Glover, oh, there's a little part of the story I haven't told you. They have a 16-year-old son who's never been kicked out of school, never been in a fight. You know, this is Detroit, where that's just commonplace, see. He and his friend have a job 4 hours a day at Herman Kiefer Hospital, or healthcare center, where they get to earn, I think it's $75 a week, and they get paid every 2 weeks. So that's nice jingle in your pocket. You haven't hit anybody in the head. You haven't snatched a purse. You haven't sold an ounce of drugs. The father, who's on dialysis, drives him and his friend to their job and picks them up every day. Then takes them to basketball practice so they're off the streets every day. I said, wow, this is just astounding, absolutely amazing. And then Mrs. Glover said to me, when some of his friends come around, they call me Mama. And I got to thinking about my mother because everybody on the block called my mother Grammy. Even the grown-ups, that's what they called her, Grammy. Because she interacted with so many people on the block, and children in particular. When the children came, because my sister used to live upstairs and she had a teenage daughter, when those teenagers came around, they straightened their act up because Grammy wasn't having it. You can't talk any old kind of way around me. You can't do any old kind of thing around me. This little 5'5 lady, some of you remember seeing her and meeting her, she wasn't having it. Okay. That's Mrs. Glover. So I have a template, or I should say an image of my mother living next door, doing the things that Mama did, and I'm saying, wow, okay, God, I'm hearing you, I'm seeing what you're saying, because Mama, my mother, didn't go to church either. You're not hearing me. You said, well, your mother, you know, the person who had this impact on you, used to be a member of the Worldwide Church and all that. Mama had church in her house every day. She helped raise parents to be better parents. What kind of impact is that? How does God analyze a situation where you didn't show up at church? You weren't there to darken the door. You weren't in a place. Now, don't anybody take me wrong and tell that I'm saying you stay home. I have to be careful to backtrack, because some people say, well, I don't have to go to church because Bronson says, you know, you are the church. No, I am not saying that. What I am saying is that Jesus, in his discourse in Matthew 25, stipulates a standard of judgment for people who are going to be on the right hand and on the left. That's Matthew 25. That's the one where he divides the sheep from the goats. But before I get to that text, let's put it in context. Jesus is asked in Matthew 24, what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And he begins to enumerate those things to watch for. We're all familiar with them. It helps to interpret the book of Revelation about there will be deception, religious deception. There will be wars and rumors of wars. There will be all of these things. Then comes a tribulation, and he goes through and delineates all of those things. But I think the most important thing he said in Matthew 24 and verse 42 was, watch, therefore. As a result of all this stuff I'm telling you, you better pay attention. You better look. Watch, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord does come. So to be on guard, to be watchful, to be attentive, to pay attention is what believers ought to be about. Pay attention. Analyze the situation. What does it portend for a nation that is secure in itself, we think, on its building prowess and its accumulation of wealth? The economy is going great. And a bridge across the mighty Mississippi collapses. How many more bridges are destined for that situation? Every time I go to New York City, I am struck by the bridges and the tunnels that are subject to catastrophe. Every time I cross the Ambassador Bridge to Canada, I think about it. Before what happened in Minneapolis. And we just take it for granted that it's going to hold up and it's going to stand. You realize that God can dispatch angels in the time of trouble to secure us in situations like that, but he will take his hands off of us when we do like ancient Israel. But that's just my observation about it. But being watchful. And in talking about being watchful, he then segues into the 25th chapter where he talks about the 10 virgins, 5 wise and 5 foolish. I don't need to spend time with that, but I hope that we are among the wise. That's what I hope. Then, after talking about these 10 virgins, he suggests that I am going to equip you with talents. I'm gifting you with some things. And I got to analyze that, because my mother used to say, before she really began in earnest keeping other people's children, she said, I wish I knew what my talent was. My one talent, she says, you know, I just don't know what my one talent is. Now, maybe some of you are in that situation where you're still trying to figure it out. Well, God has this way of just slapping you all upside your head and saying, well, you're actually doing what I put you here to do. Sometimes it's just to be an excellent mother. That's a talent. Serious talent. Because you, more than anybody else, will impact the lives of children that will grow into maturity and be productive citizens in the society. Motherhood. Not to be diminished. Not to be deplored. Not to be thought of as just drinking tea and cookies, as one presidential candidate once said. A mother. Well, a father. What about that? I had my cry for the day when I watched a replay of a presentation about my favorite baseball player, Mickey Mantle, who was very close, and by the way, he was an Oklahoman, you know, so don't hold it against Mickey. He did move to Dallas, you know, and he lived out his life in Dallas, Texas. So, but he was very close to his father, Elvin. They called him Mutt. And he was from Common, Oklahoma. Commons, Oklahoma. That's where the Mick was from. And I'm watching this replay. As he died in 1995, and I remember I was on the radio here in East Texas at that time, and I gave my own dedication to Mickey Mantle. And the thing about it was that he was close to his father, and his father had a tremendous impact on his life, but he died in his very first year as a Yankee. And he never got to see the rest of his life. And because of the loss of that father who meant so much to him, Mickey Mantle descended into alcoholic abuse. Because he had always assumed, as his father and his uncle and all of those in his family, he would have died before he was 40, because each one of them died of Hodgkin's disease. And he just assumed that, well, I'm going to die anyhow, so I'll just burn the candle on both ends and all of that. But he lived much longer. I got to thinking about fathers and what they mean, and reviewing in the course of my own life the impact on my own children and the ups and downs of that situation. But that was a talent, a gift given to exercise, and from it great fruit is to be born. Just something so simple as that. We think of talent as being able to draw and to paint or to sing or some other kind of thing, but talent is what Jesus says, I am giving because I am going away on a far journey. And when I come, I'm going to do a tally on what you have done. Now, the things that we assume Jesus is going to tally up is not what he's going to use to make his determination. How do I know that, you say? I'm glad you ask. Well, it's right here in Matthew 25. Because after talking about the talents and so forth, verse 31, let's read it. There's going to come this time of judgment. Remember back when in Micah where we says that all I ask of you, you know what the Lord requires of you, is that you do justice or justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly before your God. And I'm thinking about Mrs. Glover with this astounding example. I hear her talking to the children like adults, not baby talk. She's talking to them about things they must do. She does not permit them to fight among themselves, as my mother didn't. If I had hit my sister, I got a lick coming, or more. She just wasn't permitting that. But you see in families and movies and presentations and situations in public places like the mall, just children out of control, because nobody is reaching out to them, and especially those who birthed them into this life. Someone who has not even given birth to them dedicates themselves because of the mercy, she says, God has shown to her and the fact that her child has lived to be 22. Wow. I saw a sermon the other day. And it's predicated on something here in this passage. It says in verse 31, when the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon his throne, the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations. I think all means all. And he's about to do something. And he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. And then a song that I have sung in times past. It's called Come Ye Blessed. It's a wonderful piece. And this is where the words are taken from. It says, then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, the sheep, Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. He doesn't say, wow, what Sabbath keepers? What holy day keepers? Well, what tithers? You guys are astounding. You impress me. No, it doesn't say that. And it does not mean that I am making an argument against those things, not on my life am I doing that. But some of us need to recheck ourselves before we wreck ourselves, thinking, as the Pharisees did, that that was enough. He says, for I was an hungered, that personal pronoun, I, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in, Mrs. Glover. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me. And by the way, metaphorically, you can talk about these things in the abstract and suggest that people are imprisoned by appetites, imprisoned by situations, who are naked and need to be clothed upon with spirituality and all of it. You can go through and do that, but he's talking literally, isn't he? Then shall the righteous, those on his right hand, those who are called the sheep, say to the Lord, when saw we you a hunger and fed you, or thirsty and gave you drink? When did we see you a stranger and took you in, or naked and clothed you? When did we see you sick or in prison and came unto you? When did we see you in that condition, Lord? Jesus' response is interesting. And the king, underline that, king of kings, Lord of lords, will respond by saying, truly I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. I was astounded because my eyes got really bright and big, because I began remembering not only from the lady next door, but people across the city of Detroit and throughout the state of Michigan and beyond its boundaries into the world. And I saw a little presentation from a man in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. He was a gang member at one time. And he said, when my first child, my daughter, was born, and I held her and I realized, what shall I bequeath her? And he actually used that word. He spoke perfect English and Spanish. What shall I give to her? What shall be my legacy to my daughter? I've got to change what I'm doing, he said. Who preached to him? What church showed up? None. He came to that because God opened his mind to understand that he had a responsibility. And he didn't just stop with the fact that he had to interact with his daughter. He now recognizes, well, I need to reach out to those street children who become victims of gangs and violence and death. They wake up every day not knowing if they will see the sun go down. And I thought about all of the places in the world and the situations that are out there that people can make a difference about if they just make a commitment. You want to see the church grow? Make a commitment to something bigger than yourself. Something that you walk by every day. And God is saying, I gave you talent to address that, but you just ignored it. You just moved on because you don't want to deal, you don't want to soil your hands. You don't want to be in a situation. I've heard people say things like, well, I liked the church when it was smaller. This was a congregation that I used to interact with. It's in the state of Texas, but you'll have to figure it out. It's a big place, so I'm not going to tell you where it was. But they, when they were 10 in number, they wanted that. But when they got to be 100, oh, this is too big. It's too much we got to deal with, and different situations and people and so forth. Do you not know that people get that vibe if they're not truly welcome? And this is a welcoming congregation right here. I'm looking at people who come here just to add to the mix, who come to blend in, to be a part of what we are all about. And we can be transformed by that. I have a member of our congregation that was invited by another member who brought his entire family to church and have been there ever since. The fact that he works for the IRS, I told him I won't hold it against him. You know, because maybe there's something you can do for us along the way, you know. Very well employed, very dedicated, very supportive. His wife, his son, his mother-in-law, and sometimes a daughter that his wife had previously is also present in our worship. Because somebody in the congregation shared a word with a co-worker. That's how the church really grows. It's not from our preaching. It's not from the telecast. It's not from our booklets and tapes, CDs. That's not how it happens. It's people interacting with people that makes the difference. Now, it doesn't mean you don't do the other things, because it's a springboard to getting people interested and involved, but once they come, it's the people that make the difference. I won't read the rest of this, because he also tells the goats, because you didn't do those things, I have an issue with you. Well, when did we see you in those situations? Well, as long as you didn't do it to the least of these, my brethren, you did not do it unto me. And what does he tell them? Verse 46, and these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. That young man down there in San Salvador has transformed the lives of hundreds of young men who live on the streets, who are part of the violent circumstance and the situations of life, and have transformed them into productive citizens of a society. One person can make a difference. I like George Bush Sr. because he had this thing about 1,000 points of light. Remember that? How he began to recognize people who were doing spectacular things and transforming situations. You want to see a nation transformed? You want to see a church transformed? Then pay attention to the sermons that we run into all of the time and become a sermon.